We're in Matthew chapter 24, beginning Matthew chapter 24 this morning. Signs of the times, that's what the disciples were asking about, so I've entitled the message, Signs of the Times. Matthew 24, verses 1 through 42. Now in chapters 21 through 23, just to give us the immediate context, Jesus has been forecasting the sad destruction of Jerusalem. That's been the main topic of discussion for three chapters. Jerusalem being the capital city and a symbol of the entire nation. You might remember that first Jesus came to a fig tree that did not bear fruit. Do you remember that? And he cursed the fig tree and pronounced that it would never bear fruit again. That was in Matthew 21, 18 and 19. Who do you think the fig tree represented, you see? Then Jesus told them the parable of the husbandman who the vineyard owner placed in charge of the vineyard. This is in Matthew 21, 33 through 44. And when the owner sent his servants to collect the fruit of the vineyard, the husbandman killed the servants. And when the owner sent his own son, they killed the son. And Jesus interpreted the parable and told them that the kingdom would be taken from them and given to another nation. This is a clear reference to the kingdom being taken from Israel and given to another people. Then Jesus told them the parable of the marriage feast. This is in Matthew 22, 1 through 14. The king sent special invitations out to the son's wedding, his son's wedding. But the special invitees would not come. Who do you think the special invitees represent, you see? And when the king's servants came with the invitations, the special invitees killed the king's servants. Then the king sent out an open invitation to anyone who would come. All of these are examples of the blatant unfaithfulness of Israel to receive God's Son and to enter into the kingdom. And they are examples of God's judgment upon Israel. Finally, God turns to another people, the Gentiles, or at least the called among the Gentiles. So this is what we've seen in the preceding three chapters, judgment coming upon the nation. And this will be the continuing subject in chapter 24. I want you to also note that this discourse of Jesus is recorded in three places, Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. Interestingly, it's not recorded in John. The reason probably is that John wrote his gospel probably after the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. So John may have written after all of that. Let's take a look at the setting, first of all, Matthew 24, 1. It says, "And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple." You'll notice that Jesus has just left the temple. The temple was a very glorious structure, by the way. It was called Herod's temple because it was built by Herod. Herod had all the resources of Rome to do it. It was very grand and glorious. It was a huge and magnificent structure. Each side of the temple, by the way, was longer than a football field. So you can imagine what kind of structure it was. It was made of white marble and was one of the wonders of the ancient world. Now, when Jesus left the temple, it seems that he began to climb the Mount of Olives with his disciples, and undoubtedly they were able to look down on the glorious temple structures. And the disciples came to Jesus to show him the buildings. So that sets the stage. Jesus and the disciples are on the Mount of Olives looking down over the city of Jerusalem and particularly the temple structures. Now let's take a look at the prophecy of Jesus in verse 2. Jesus gives us a prophecy here, you see. He foretells the future. And Jesus told them something very astonishing. It says, "And Jesus said unto them, See ye not all these things?" What are they looking at? the temple. Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. This is a very astonishing proclamation. It would be like someone stating that the day was coming when all the buildings of New York City would be thrown down and not one stone would be left upon another. Now that'd be quite an astonishing proclamation, wouldn't it? Today, we would be imagining a nuclear calamity. Surely to cause such a devastation, a nuclear bomb, or perhaps several, will fall on the city. And if you lived in New York City, and someone said that all the buildings would be thrown down and not one stone would be left upon another, what would be the first question to pop into your mind? When? You see? Do I need to get out of town today? Next week? Or will it be 40 years from now? Do we need to pack all of our stuff up now and get out? If total devastation is coming, we need to know when. And that's exactly what the disciples asked Jesus when they were alone privately. And so we see the question of the disciples in verse 3. Take a look at verse 3. And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, tell us when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? We learn, by the way, from Mark 13:3 that it was only four disciples who asked Jesus this question. It wasn't all of them, but it was four. It was Peter and James and John and Andrew, who came privately to find out when these things would be. Now, one of the things that makes this passage somewhat cloudy is that we don't know what was the understanding of the disciples. You have to understand that we have the advantage of 2,000 years of hindsight, don't we? But the disciples were pondering future things. Their understanding was undoubtedly cloudy. More than likely, their understanding was even faulty. It seems that they were even having trouble understanding that Jesus was about to die. They had a hard time grasping the fact that Jesus was about to die. They had very little comprehension of His death and His resurrection. They could hardly be expected to understand the order of future events very clearly. It's very likely that they believed that the destruction of Jerusalem closely coincided with the return of Christ and of the end of the world. Perhaps they even thought it was the same event. Their whole life was wrapped up in Jerusalem. And they may have interpreted the destruction of Jerusalem to be an event marking the end of the world, the present world order, and the setting up of Christ's kingdom. Now, you and I have the advantage of history, and we now know that the destruction of Jerusalem did not coincide with the consummation or the consummate second coming of Christ. And the destruction of Jerusalem did not coincide with the end of the world. We now know it, but it's highly questionable whether the disciples knew it at this time. So we have some uncertainty about the intent of their question. Were they asking essentially one question? As though the destruction of Jerusalem and the coming of Christ and the end of the world were one event? Or were they asking about two different events or about three different events? What we do know is that they asked specifically about the destruction of Jerusalem, the coming of Christ, and the end of the world. Another uncertainty that we have is what the disciples meant by the coming of Christ. 2,000 years later, when we talk about the coming of Christ, we're talking about His consummate coming. At the end, when He comes to raise the dead and judge the world. That's what we mean by the coming of Christ. But what did the disciples mean by it, you see? Did they have some concept that the last about the last coming of Christ? You have to remember that the disciples did not have 1 Thessalonians 4, did they? Didn't have it. That was to be written by Paul later. They didn't have 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 through 13. And when they asked, "What shall be the sign of thy coming?" it's possible, maybe even likely, that they were envisioning Christ coming back to destroy Jerusalem. After all, that's what they've been hearing about for the last three chapters. It's very possible that they anticipated that after His death, Christ would almost immediately come back to destroy the temple and to bring judgment upon Israel and to end this present world order and to set up His kingdom. That may have been what they were thinking. And they wanted to know when this would be and what signs to look for. I have a suspicion that they thought all of these things would happen simultaneously. And they may have had a completely different understanding of the coming of Christ than what we do today. So, understanding that the question of the disciples may have been based on some misconceptions, let's take a look at the answer of Christ. That's really what we're interested in, you see. Not their misconceptions, but what Christ says. So we have now the answer of Christ, some preliminary observations. We're going to take a look at the answer of Christ in much more detail in the following weeks. But let's note a few things about the answer of Christ and some things about this passage. First of all, you'll note here that Christ doesn't try to correct any misconceptions. Even though there may have been some misconceptions in the minds of the disciples about the order of events to follow, Christ doesn't make an effort to correct those misconceptions, at least not in this written record, you see. He may have taken them aside later. Don't know. But one thing we know for sure is it's not given to men to know all things. Have you come to realize that in your Christian life? It's not given to men to know all things. Sometimes God leaves us in a state of confusion. God knows all things, and we don't need to know all things. Our trust is in Him, wholly and completely. If God sheds a little light on future things, then we're blessed to have a little light. Secondly, we'll note here that prophecy tends to be obscure. Almost all prophecy tends to be somewhat obscure to those to whom the prophecy is given, you see, because it's future events. Prophecy has always tended to be somewhat obscure and uncertain until the events actually occur. And then those who see it occur say, "Ah, now we understand. Now we see what he meant by that." The people who first hear the prophecy often are left scratching their heads and wondering what it means. This is just the nature of prophecy. The disciples were very interested in the destruction of the temple and the judgment upon Jerusalem. And the impending destruction of the temple and the judgment upon Israel was most relevant to them. That was on the forefront of their minds. Some of them would actually live to see it, by the way. And so most of chapter 24 can be applied first to the destruction of the temple and the judgment upon Israel, which ultimately occurred in AD 70. I think most of you are aware that the Romans, under the generalship of Titus, surrounded Jerusalem in AD 70 and finally took it by siege and completely tore down the temple so that no stone was left upon another. It was a total devastation. They utterly and literally fulfilled the words of Jesus less than 40 years after Jesus spoke these words. But I want you to also notice or think about that the coming of Christ can be applied to His coming in AD 70 to destroy Jerusalem. In a sense, when the Romans came in AD 70, this was the or a coming of Christ. Christ often uses wicked men and wicked nations to do His bidding. You might remember that He used Assyria as a rod upon the Israelites, especially the northern kingdom and the south. And so it's not wrong to say that Christ came in the person of Titus and the Roman army to destroy the city and the temple in AD 70. This was a coming of Christ in judgment. I suspect this was what the disciples had in mind when they said, "What shall be the sign of thy coming?" I don't know for sure because I don't know what was in the minds of the disciples. Fourthly, the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 was, in a sense, the end of the world for the Jews. In a sense, this was the end of the world for the Jewish nation. Their capital city was torn down. Their place of worship was torn down. They fled for their lives to other parts of the world where they would be scattered and displaced. And I suspect that the disciples viewed this event as the end of the world as they knew it. They probably expected Jesus to set up His kingdom at this time. And so they asked, "When shall these things be?" But Jesus didn't waste time correcting every misconception or every cloudy idea of the disciples, if they had cloudy ideas. But as we shall see in our text, it appears that He did answer their question about signs preceding the destruction of Jerusalem. And He did address their question about the signs of His coming, whatever that might have been. And He did answer their question as to signs preceding the end of the world. The disciples may have walked away that day thinking that His answer was all about that one day when Christ would come and destroy Jerusalem and end the present world order and set up His kingdom. But we see a little more clearly 2,000 years later, after more revelation has been given. We have the advantage of historical insight. We have the advantage of subsequent biblical revelation. And perhaps we can see past the limited understanding of the disciples. Let me say that as we read through this text, we also are going to find it difficult to be sure which event is in view. I know that if you've read through Matthew 24, you've had the same questions come into your mind. Is Christ talking only about signs preceding the destruction of Jerusalem? Is He talking about signs preceding His second coming at the end of the world? Does He start out talking about the destruction of the temple and then transition into the second coming at the end of the world? When Christ says that the end shall come, is He talking about the end of the temple in Jerusalem? Or is He talking about the end of the world? You see, these are questions that we have as we read. These are legitimate questions. Excellent theologians have had different opinions. And I suppose we will know for sure when the events of history play out. Perhaps when Christ explains it to us in heaven someday, One of these days we will see Christ face to face and we can ask Him, which one did this verse apply to? Was it the destruction of Jerusalem or the end of the world at the consummation? Fifthly, there is good reason to believe that the events described by Christ in this chapter relate at least, first of all, to the signs which would precede the destruction of Jerusalem. The disciples asked, "When shall these things be?" The immediate context is that Jesus told them that the temple would be leveled to the ground. That's in verse 2. And then the disciples say, "When shall these things be?" Jesus said, "There shall not be left here one stone upon another, and that shall not be thrown down." And as He sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto Him privately saying, "Tell us, when shall these things be?" That was the first element of their question and their primary concern. And so we must assume that Jesus enters into this discourse to answer their immediate question about the destruction of the temple. During the discourse, Jesus seems to refer to things which will personally affect these disciples. Take a look at verse 9, Matthew 24 and verse 9. "Then shall they deliver you to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake." Certainly seems that Jesus is speaking directly to the four disciples about things that will happen to them personally. And so we have to assume that the answer of Christ applies to the disciples personally and addresses things that will precede the destruction of Jerusalem. Also, the passage speaks about a local judgment in Judea. Did you notice that in verse 16? "Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains." Look at verse 20. "But pray ye that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the," what? "Sabbath day." That's a Jewish thing. You can see that Jesus is not speaking primarily about a universal judgment, but by a judgment coming upon Jerusalem. He doesn't say, "Let them which be in Memphis, Tennessee, flee to the mountains." But He says, "Let those in Judea flee into the mountains." Also, He says, "But pray ye that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day." The Sabbath day is uniquely Jewish and would not apply to any other people of the world. Also, notice that even toward the end of this prophecy, Jesus still seems to be speaking about things that would apply to the disciples and things that would come to pass within their generation. Verses 33 and 34, "So likewise ye, when ye shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. Verily I say unto you, this generation..." I take that to mean the generation that was standing before Him, although it could be argued otherwise. "But this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled." So the passage must be, at least in part, about signs which will precede the destruction of Jerusalem. But number 6... some of the language of this chapter seems that it could also apply to the coming of Christ at the end of the world, doesn't it? Look at verse 14. "And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come." Look at verse 21 and 22. "For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved, but for the elect's sake those days shall be shortened." Verse 27, "For as the lightning cometh out of the east and shineth even unto the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be." verses 29 through 31. Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken, and then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory, and he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Don't see how you can really read those verses without projecting to the end of the world. Especially from our perspective 2,000 years later. So, which are they? Events which precede the destruction of Jerusalem, or events which precede the coming of Christ at the consummation? And here's my stab at an answer. Many times, prophecy has what we call a near and a far fulfillment. Have you ever heard of that? It can apply to a near event, which is typical of a far event. In the book of Isaiah, we have a prophecy concerning the destruction of Babylon. We all went over this a couple of years ago when we were studying Isaiah. And this destruction of Babylon in this passage in Isaiah 13 is called the Day of the Lord. It was Judgment Day for Babylon. And in this passage in verse 10, Isaiah 13:10, it says, "For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in his going forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine." This is not talking about the end of the world in Isaiah 13. It's talking about the destruction of Babylon by the Medes. This is clearly figurative language concerning the destruction of Babylon by the Medes in verse 17 of Isaiah 13. In other words, the lights were going to go out for Babylon. This was the near fulfillment. But many people think there's a far fulfillment of this prophecy. Babylon is a type of the world. And in the end, this prophecy may be played out literally, you see. When Christ comes to judge and destroy this present world, perhaps the sun literally will be put out. And the stars won't shine, and the moon will not give her light. And the same thing may be true in Matthew 24. You'll notice in Matthew 24:29, we're talking, I think, about the destruction of Jerusalem primarily. And he says, "Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken." Almost the same language that we saw in Isaiah. And there could be a double fulfillment here. It could certainly apply to Israel in the figurative sense. It is virtually the same language forecast for Babylon. It's an oriental expression commonly employed to describe the end of a nation's existence. The sun's going to die out for you, Babylon. But here's the question. Is there a far fulfillment which will occur in a fuller or a more literal sense? It certainly seems that Christ is describing something consummate at the end of the world as we know it. It seems that the judgment upon Israel in AD 70 is in some way a type of the judgment on the world at the end of time. There is certainly a near fulfillment. Look what Jesus told the disciples in verses 33 and 34. "So likewise ye, when ye shall see all these things, know that it is near. Even at the doors, verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things shall be fulfilled." I think Jesus was talking about a near fulfillment. It certainly seems to me that all of these signs applied at least in some way to the near event of the destruction of Jerusalem, even though the language seems very end of the worldish, doesn't it? But it also seems that there's a far fulfillment which is broader in scope and perhaps fulfilled in a more literal way. And so as we study this passage, let's see the near and the far, you see. Let's see both the figurative and the literal. And I think we'll have a fuller understanding of this passage. So, see, many people think that Isaiah 24 is all about the destruction of Jerusalem. Others say, no, it's all about the second coming of Christ at the end of the world. I say it's about both. It has a fulfillment in both, the near and the end. And when we study this, we're going to have to consider both the near and the far. And perhaps both are true. All right, well, that was a little introduction to Matthew 24, and we'll be going verse by verse and contemplating these things as we go forward.